evening, listeners and students of Hitler's Table Talk. This is episode 4 on March 27th, 2014, and I'm Carolyn Yeager.
And I'm Ray Goodwin.
And we are here to bring you, as I said, episode 4, and tonight we're beginning with the late night, August 1st and 2nd, 1941. I thought I would begin giving some of the events that were taking place on this date. And I looked at the last minute, got this idea, and I looked for timelines for World War II, and there's several of them, but I started with the first one I saw, which was Wikipedia, and just give you a little information about what was going on at this time. On the 21st, the Luftwaffe strikes heavily at Moscow, it says, and on the 26th of July, Roosevelt orders a seizure of all Japanese assets in the United States, and Germans ordered a Judenrat established in Stanislavov, that's Galicia, which is pretty much like Poland or Russia-Poland, which they were occupying then, and it was headed by Israel Siebald. Well, that was a Jewish council of the Jews there, you know, headed by themselves to organize themselves and to stay where they were supposed to stay. And let's see, I'm going to skip what's going on in Japan. The Germans push against Smolensk on the 28th. They solidify their presence in the Baltic states. And, okay, 31st, under instruction of Adolf Hitler, Hermann Göring orders Reinhard Heydrich to, quote, submit to me as soon as possible a general plan of the administrative material and financial measures necessary for carrying out the desired final solution of the Jewish question, unquote. Well, you know, Ray, that Hermann Göring said at Nuremberg that that was a wrong, bad translation of what was said at the Von See and other papers that they had, and that the words he used meant complete solution, not final solution.
Mm-hmm.
But as usual, they don't pay any attention to that. They just keep saying final solution.
Oh, yeah.
So that was starting then. You know, we got to realize we're in August or July. And starting on August 1941 already. And if you have some comments you want to make, go ahead and then start reading with our night of 1st, 2nd August.
Okay.
You please.
Yeah. All right. This is, of course, quoting Hitler. I am often urged to say something in praise of bureaucracy. I can't do it. It's certain that we have a clean, incorruptible administration, but it's also too punctilious. It's over-organized, and at least in certain sectors, it's overloaded. Its principal fault is that nobody in it is seeking for success, and that it includes too many people without responsibility. Our functionaries fear initiative worse than anything else, and what a way they have of behaving as if they were nailed to their office chairs. We have much more elasticity in the army, with the exception of one sector of the Wehrmacht, than in these civilian sectors, and that although the salaries are often inadequate. Their fixed idea is that legislation should be the same for the whole Reich. Why not a different regulation for each part of the Reich? They imagine that it's better to have a regulation which is bad but uniform, rather than a good regulation that would take account of particular circumstances. If I may interrupt right there with my own comment here, Carolyn, having taught American history on the college level for a few years, this is astonishingly a states' rightist, a southern point of view for Hitler to say, why not a different regulation for each part of the Reich? That's nothing less than the laws of each United States for that state. And so many people are confused and always say about, well, the Constitution says this, the Constitution. The Constitution that they are referring to is the federal Constitution that was meant to govern the federal government only. Each of the states had their own constitutions because laws were more particular to where certain people settled, what their beliefs were, And I'm talking things like segregated schools, about prohibitions of interracial marriage, things like this, that the federal government came along and said, no, your laws are illegal. We're going to have to make them all uniform. And Hitler is saying right here, hey, uniform rather than a good regulation that would take account of particular circumstances is a waste of time. And then going back to what Hitler says, what matters for them is simply that the higher bosses should have a comprehensive view of the activity of the administration and should pull all the strings. The Wehrmacht gives its highest distinction to the man who, acting against orders, saves the situation by his discernment and decisiveness. In the administration, the fact of not carrying out an order makes a man liable to the most severe penalty. The administration ignores the exception, and that's why it lacks the courage which is indispensable to those who are to assume responsibilities.
Let's talk about this a little bit more then, because I noticed that too, and I know that I have read other things where, Hitler would be critical of when people were too stuck in their ways, like in the bureaucracies. Mm-hmm. And so, it's not surprising that he's saying this, but at the same time, he wanted a unified federal government, mm-hmm. State. And of course, Germany was a whole lot smaller than the United States. And he worked hard to make everybody feel there to be a part of the one thing and to behave the same. But obviously, he didn't think that it had to be that strict, mm-hmm. and that different areas had to be, exceptions had to be made. And he was a big one for making exceptions because he made a lot of exceptions himself. Laws were set down, and then if somebody questioned it, well, it would come to him, and he would usually would come up to him finally, and then he would decide whether if he could make an exception, and he so often did. Mm-hmm. At least maybe those are the ones we hear about. Mm-hmm. But the last part, he's talked about that on other occasions, that the officers, and this was in relation to the military officers, need to have the courage to make responsible decisions and not always follow the rule book, and he encouraged that. You couldn't do things you shouldn't do, but at the same time, if you're in a special situation and you realized as a leader that this was the right, certain mm-hmm. approach was the right thing to do, he wanted you to do that.
That's right.
And he called it being courageous because it's easy to follow orders. He really didn't want, did he, Ray? He didn't want a bureaucracy or a bunch of a government of people who were wanting him to tell them what to do every step of the way.
Right.
And he found a lot of them did want that.
Mm-hmm,
because
right.
They didn't want the responsibility on themselves. Because of course they might have been afraid that they'd do something, they'd get in trouble for it. So mm-hmm. he was telling them that, you wouldn't get in trouble for it if the outcome turned, if the outcome turned out well. But that's where people have to, this is where he was encouraging, this independence of mind.
That's right.
At the same time as being realizing what was wanted by the whole. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a tricky situation.
What he did was place the responsibility on the individual to use their discernment, their decisiveness, and rather than sit back and be afraid to act because you're afraid of your job, let's just go along and let things rock along here as slow as a snail pace, but don't rock the boat. And like he really criticizes people in the administration for shirking responsibility or backing off and then even using the military man, the guy who should follow orders to a T, but so admired is the one who dares to say, hey, these orders are going to get a bunch of my men killed if I don't do the right thing here, so to hell with the orders. He takes charge decisiveness and takes responsibility. And Hitler's had a negative view of all these bureaucrats because they were so afraid of responsibility or taking responsibility.
Well, it's just easier to just have a rule there and follow it, and you don't have to just make, you know, it's not something you have to grapple with. But mm-hmm. he felt this way even about generals and so on. I mean, if mm-hmm. even though the plan was to do such and such, if it was clear to the officer that something else would do better, and if it turned out better, you know, I mean, you couldn't sure. have disasters. Mm-hmm. So this was a lot of responsibility, and he felt that people, privileged people and like officers, were chosen because they had these higher abilities and that they had to take responsibility even if maybe turned out badly for them, but they had to do it. And this was the kind of man he was trying to create. Mm-hmm. This, what they've turned into calling the Superman, but the master race thing, you know, but what mm-hmm. he was really trying to do was this kind of thing where men were acting and doing what they knew, what they thought was right, and not always knowing if they were going to be supported in it.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
In the end, but he did support people who made brilliant decisions.
Right.
That's for sure. Okay, well, that took a while, didn't it?
And then going on with what Hitler said, one favorable circumstance in view of the changes of method that are called for is that we are going to have a continent to rule. When that happens, the different positions of the sun will bar us from uniformity, meaning different positions of the sun, different nations, and the way their own nations have their own laws. And so something uniform would just make the people go against that.
He's saying, and he says it a lot, that he thinks that they're going to be the ruling, the way things are going at the time, they're going to be the ruling,
of a very large
area of space.
Yes.
And when you have all these different, because people aren't going to be that, you know, if you're the governor general of an area way out in the east, you're going to do what's best for that area and what fits in there. And you're not going to be doing what fits in or doing exactly the same as somebody way in the west. So, mm-hmm. well, that's exactly what you said. But, I mean, it's he's looking at the big plan and what kind of challenges will be coming up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Sure. Going on with Hitler's comments, in many places we shall have to control immense regions with a handful of men. Thus, the police there will have to be constantly on the alert. What a chance for men from the party. We must pay the price for our experiences, of course. Mistakes are inevitable. But what difference do they make if in 10 years I can be told that Danzig, Alsace, and Lorraine are now German? What will it matter, then, if it can be added that the 3 or 4 mistakes have been made at Colmar and 5 or 6 in other places? Let's take the responsibilities for these mistakes and save the provinces. In 10 years, we'll have formed an elite, of whom we know that we can count on them whenever there are new difficulties to master. We'll produce from it all a new type of man, a race of rulers, a breed of viceroys. Of course, there'll be no question of using people like that in the West. And that wraps up for August 1st.
Yeah, so you know, I know that he's thinking about the British Empire, mm-hmm. and he has said before, maybe in this in here, but or previous day, but and other times that he admired that they were able to rule over these areas far from their home base mm-hmm. with a small number of men,
mm-hmm.
and why they could do that, and why they
yes.
did do it, and why it worked out. And he's just saying, well, we're going to have to be doing something similar. But he was seeing always the German areas being continuous, not going off into individual places around the world, but being that one area right there, you know, in Central and Eastern Europe, so to speak.
Correct.
And maybe more, but that was, and he thought that was just the ideal, where you could travel on land, you know, from one end to the other. So they didn't need to have a big navy, that, like Britain did.
Mm-hmm.
And, I think when he was talking about the race of rulers, and then he said there'll be no question of using people like that in the West, I take this as him saying that the people in the West would not be ruled in the same way that the people in the East.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know what you think. That's the way I see it.
Yeah.
And people in the East today, Eastern Europeans today, don't like hearing that. They don't like that. But, I mean, I think that's what he thought, that there would need to be a different approach.
Mm-hmm.
In the East, and
right.
Of course in the West everybody was already on board more.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah. Correct.
Yeah. Okay, now going to, looks like this is some more my timeline. The next recorded part is on August 2nd at midday. So that was that late night before,
mm-hmm.
and now we're at midday the next day. And on some things that occurred on August 2nd were that civilian radios in Norway were confiscated by the German occupation. Now, remember, this is from Wikipedia, so everything is from the Allied point of view. But the people weren't supposed to be listening to their radios because they were going to get information from Britain, for
mm-hmm.
sure, you know. And I just put this down here, but I don't see that there's anything very worthwhile there. So, okay. I guess I'll start reading. There's nothing astonishing about the fact that communism had its strongest bastion in Saxony, or that it took us time to win over the Saxon workers to our side. Nor is it astonishing that they are now counted amongst our most loyal supporters. Of course, Saxony is a state central to the north part of Germany. I know that Leopold Wenger, when he was staying in somewhere in Saxony for a while in his training, he didn't like the Saxon people, and he said, "Oh God, these Saxons, you know, just
mm-hmm.
terrible." So I guess they were kind of hard to get along with there. This is exactly what Hitler's talking about here. He says, "It took us time to win over the Saxon workers to our side. Nor is it astonishing that they are now counted amongst our most loyal supporters. The Saxon bourgeoisie was incredibly narrow-minded. These people insisted that we were mere communists because they were socialists." See, these were the real, staid, anti-communist people.
Right.
"Anyone who proclaims the right to social equality for the masses is a Bolshevik. The way in which they exploited the home worker was unimaginable. It's a real crime to have turned the Saxon workers into proletarians. There was a ruling plutocracy in those parts comparable to what still exists today in England." Just like the plutocracy.
Mm-hmm.
"Recruiting for the Wehrmacht enabled us to observe the progressive lowering of the quality of the human material in this region. I don't blame the small man for turning communist, but I blame the intellectual who did nothing but exploit other people's poverty for other ends. When one thinks of that riffraff of a bourgeoisie, even today one sees red." So he's calling the bourgeoisie a riffraff.
Mm-hmm.
"The masses followed the only course possible. The worker took no part in national life. When a monument was unveiled to the memory of Bismarck, or when a ship was launched, no delegation of workers was ever invited. Only the frock coats and uniforms." The bourgeoisie and ministers and so on in the military.
Mm-hmm.
"For me, the top hat is the signature of the bourgeoisie. I sometimes entertain myself by rummaging through old back numbers of the Volga, the old films, I think. I have a collection of them. It's truly instructive to plunge one's nose in them. At the launching of a ship, nothing but top hats, even after the revolution. The people were invited to such festivities only as stage extras. The Kaiser received a delegation of workers once. He gave them a fine scolding, threatened simply to withdraw the imperial favor from them. At their local meetings, I suppose, the delegates had plenty of time in which to draw their conclusions from the imperial speech. When war came, the harm had been done, and it was too late to go into reverse. Moreover, people were too cowardly to crush social democracy. It's what Bismarck wanted to do, but with the corollary of good social legislation. If they'd followed that path systematically, it would have led us to our goal in less than 20 years. So this is showing that, you know, he saw himself as a revolutionary. He wasn't a revolutionary in the sense of the communists, but he was a more responsible type of revolutionary, but still wanted to break from the past. Then he says, Thalmann is the very type of those mediocrities who can't act otherwise than as they have acted. Now, Thalmann was the leader of the Communist Party of Germany during much of the Weimar Republic. And there's a big statue to him in Berlin now that I just happened to cross when I was there walking from one of the big, I think, art museums or something in the, and walking toward the center of, to the center of the, I don't know, the tourist district, the center of town. And it wasn't very far, so I thought I'd walk, and I just came upon this, and I was looking at it, took some pictures of it. But you see, that's left there. Everything from the Third Reich is torn down. Mm-hmm. But this stuff from the communist era is all still there. Anyway, so he talks about Thalmann here, and he said he's not as intelligent. Thalmann was not as intelligent as Torgler, for example. Torgler was the chairman of the Communist Party of Germany in the German Reichstag, the communist faction in the German Reichstag. And so Hitler says of Thalmann, I think. I'm not sure which one. He's a narrow-minded man. That's why I let Torgler go free while I had to keep Thalmann locked up, not in revenge, but to prevent him from being a nuisance. And as he says, I had to keep Thalmann locked up. Mm-hmm. He's not doing it because he hates these people, whatever, but he feels that he had to in order that he wouldn't be creating a lot of problems. As soon as the danger in Russia has been removed, I'll let him go, too, Thalmann. I don't need to lock up the Social Democrats. Indeed, all I ever had to fear from them was that they might find some base abroad to support their attacks on us. Our pact with Russia never implied that we might be led to adopt a different attitude towards the danger within. Taken by themselves, I find our communists 1,000 times more sympathetic than Starenberg, say. They were sturdy fellows. Pity they didn't stay a little longer in Russia. They would have come back completely cured. if they really knew what it was like there. But now this Starenberg, I looked him up. He was an Austrian nationalist and a conservative politician prior to World War II. He was a leader of the Heimwehr in Austria and later of the Christian Social, of the Fatherland Front, which was the Christian Social Party. Or that was the ruling government at the time. After the Anschluss in 1938, Starenberg escaped to Switzerland, and he later served in the British and Free French Air Forces. So he turned traitor, and that was at the beginning of the war, and when Hitler invaded the Soviet Union and brought the Western powers in alliance with communism. He didn't like that, so he left them, and he went to Argentina in 1942, and that's where he stayed until almost toward the end of his life. So he didn't fit in anywhere, this Starenberg, but Hitler thought very poorly of him. Well, that brings us to the next thing. You want to read that one?
Sure.
And then maybe I think this is short, so maybe this and the next one.
Just one more comment over the material we just covered.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
That one statement that Hitler said, these people insisted that we were mere communists. And then he says, anyone who proclaims the right to social equality for the masses is a Bolshevik. That should be applied to the USA and the 40s and 50s of this proclamation of social equality of the masses, et cetera, et cetera. Should have recognized that for what it was. Hitler hit the nail on the head. They're Bolsheviks. Just personal opinion there. Okay, going back to 2nd of August, 1941, during dinner. In the same way as owners of moors take care a long time in advance of the game that they'll kill in the shooting season, so lawyers take care of the criminal class. The greatest vice of our penal system is the exaggerated importance attached to a first sentence. Corporal punishment would often be much better than a term of imprisonment. In prison and in penitentiary establishments, the delinquent is at too good a school. The old lags he meets there teach him, first, that he was stupid to get caught, and secondly, to do better next time. All that his stay in prison amounts to in the end is only an uninterrupted course of instruction in the art of doing wrong. A murder had just been committed in Berlin. There was much talk of it in the press, and Schaub asked the Führer how long it would take for the case to come up for trial.
And of course, this was Julius Schaub, his personal aide that everybody knows so well, was always there, always around.
And he asked for Hitler's comment on that, and Hitler says, in such a case, I see no sense in a long trial with all its formalities to study the question of responsibility or irresponsibility. In my view, whether responsible or not, the author of that crime should disappear.
Okay. Well, he was very clear about these kind of criminals. He didn't he didn't take a soft line ever. He took a hard line.
Mm-hmm.
And further along, I think he talks more about that.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, go ahead.
Okay, the 2nd of August, 1941, evening. When Russia barricades herself within her frontiers, it's to prevent people from leaving the country and making certain comparisons. That's why Stalin was obliged to introduce Bolshevism into the Baltic countries so that his army of occupation should be deprived of all means of comparison with another system. At the beginning, that wasn't Stalin's idea at all. It's important that we should shape Germany in such a way that whoever comes to visit us may be cured of his prejudices concerning us. I don't want to force National Socialism on anybody. If I'm told that some countries want to remain Democrats, very well, they must remain Democrats at all costs. The French, for example, ought to retain their parties. The more social revolutionary parties they have in their midst, the better it would be for us. The way we're behaving now, just now, is exactly right. Many Frenchmen don't want us to leave Paris, since their relations with us have made them suspect in the eyes of the Vichy French. Similarly, Vichy perhaps does not take too dim a view of our being installed in Paris, since if we weren't there, they would have to be aware of revolutionary movements.
Yeah, they'd have to beware.
Yeah, beware, excuse me.
Beware, yeah.
Beware of revolutionary movements. Once the economy has been definitely organized, we shall have to see to increasing our livestock. We shall also have to devote 100,000 acres to the cultivation of rubber. Because of the fault of capitalism, which considers only private interests, the exploitation of electricity generated by water power is in Germany only in its infancy. The most important hydroelectric installations will have to be reserved in the first place for the most important consumers, for the chemical industry, for example. We shall have to use every method of encouraging whatever might ensure us the gain of a single kilowatt. Let's not forget the old-style mills. If water flows, it's enough to build a dam to obtain energy. Coal will disappear one day, but there will always be water. It can all be exploited more rationally. One can build dams upon dams and make use of the slightest slopes. Thus, one has a steady yield, and one can build beyond the reach of bombing. The new Fischer process is one of the finest inventions ever discovered. One day, Norway will have to be the electrical center of Northern Europe. In that way, the Norwegians will at last find a European mission to fulfill. I haven't studied the problem as regards Sweden. In Finland, unfortunately, there's nothing to be done. If all our cities adopted the method used in Munich for producing lighting gas by recovering it, that would be an enormous gain. In Munich, 12% of the gas for lighting is obtained in this fashion. In the Welserheide, the gas comes out of the earth. The town of Wels is heated in this way. I should not be surprised if petroleum were discovered there one day. But the future belongs, surely, to water, to the wind, and the tides. As a means of heating, it's probably hydrogen that will be chosen.
I found that I really enjoyed that part. It just shows Hitler's expansive vision of how great he wanted to make Europe and the life of the people there and whoever was a part of this whole system, that he wasn't going to turn people into slaves in the East, but he was going to expect that they would, do what he thought they were properly best at doing, or not, you know, up to their level of ability and so on. So this is the way he saw everything. I like the way he talks about gas and so on. It's fascinating that, and they, you know, Germans have in them, and he did too, this sense of making use of everything and not wasting anything. Mm-hmm. And here they have this thing of lighting gas by recovering it. He said, he talks about this here. It seems like there was more about it somewhere else, but maybe not. Where he said, you know, there's some way that you can make it go further and make it, use it kind of like over again, or do two or three things with this gas and heat things while you're at it and so on. I don't know. Maybe we're going to come up to some of that yet. But that's because I don't see what I was thinking of here. Okay. Well, now on the 6th of August, one of the things that was going on was that the Germans took Smolensk. There had been a lot of the battles going on around there, and Smolensk is a Russian city that is in the western part. We were talking about it before, Ray, southwest of Moscow, right? And so they were heading for Moscow, this one part of the front, and they did manage to take Smolensk on the 6th. So now on the night of the 8th and 9th of August, and also that's from, then it says 10 a.m. to midday, 10 p.m. to midnight, and night of 9th and 10th August. That doesn't make sense to me. But anyway, we're talking about the 8th, 9th, and 10th of August, 1941. And he is saying, the basic reason for... talking about the unpopularity of the German school teacher. The basic reason for English pride is India. 400 years ago, the English didn't have this pride. The vast spaces over which they spread their rule obliged them to govern millions of people, and they kept these multitudes in order by granting a few men unlimited power. There's the thing we were talking about earlier, how they managed to do it. It would obviously have been impossible for them to keep great European areas supplied with foodstuffs and other articles of prime necessity. There was therefore no question for them, with a handful of men, to regulate life on these new continents. In any case, the Anglicans never sustained the slightest effort of a missionary description. Thus it was that the Indians never suffered any attack of this sort upon their spiritual integrity. That is, they were not trying to convert them to anything English. They let them be what they were and had a separation between them, the two. The German made himself detested everywhere in the world because wherever he showed himself, he began to play the teacher. It's not a good method of conquest. Every people has its customs to which it clings, and nobody wants lessons from us. Now, people should listen, should remember that. That was his intention. The sense of duty, as we understand it, is not known amongst the Russians. Why should we try to inculcate this notion into them? All right, well, now that's part of his, what he thinks, and he's not speaking out of ignorance, but you can disagree with it, but he says, Russians don't have this sense of duty that Germans do. Of course, the sense of duty is really developed in Germans. Mm-hmm. And it is in the English too, who are a Germanic race. So, but he says the Russians don't have that particular kind of sense. And he says the German, so you're not going to try to, make them try to be that, turn them into that. Mm-hmm. The German colonists ought to live on handsome, spacious farms. The German services will be lodged in marvelous buildings, the Germans in palaces. Beneath the shelter of the administrative services, we shall gradually organize all that is indispensable to the maintenance of a certain standard of living. Around the city, to a depth of 30 to 40 kilometers, we shall have a belt of handsome, that means the city that the indigenous, the people who mm-hmm. are native to that area are living in. And around that, there'll be this 30 to 40 kilometer, what's that, about 20 miles or something or less.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. She'll have a belt of handsome villages connected by the best roads. So everything's going to be new and wonderful. What exists beyond that will be another world in which we mean to let the Russians live as they like. It is merely necessary that we should rule them. In the event of a revolution, we shall only have to drop a few bombs. This sounds terrible. But, he's just chatting here. Mm-hmm. We shall only have to drop a few bombs on their cities, and the affair will be liquidated. Once a year, we shall lead a troop of Kirghizes through the capital of the Reich in order to strike their imaginations with the size of our monuments. Mm-hmm. Well, he's kind of imagining that they'd leave the Russian people alone in their towns and cities mm-hmm. and so on, and they'd live surrounding it, in this area surrounding it, mm-hmm. and if a revolution came up, now that's a serious affair, I mean, a real revolution, they started really revolting against the whole thing. They would have to, he thought, well, we just drop a few bombs and that should stop it. Mm-hmm. That's what he thought. So, then right. It's not as bad as it sounds. Right. What India was for England, the territories of Russia will be for us. If only I could make the German people understand what this space means for our future. This eastern space. Colonies are a precarious possession, but this ground is safely ours. Europe is not a geographic entity, it's a racial entity. We understand now why the Chinese shut themselves up behind a wall to protect themselves against the eternal attacks of the Mongols. One could sometimes wish that a huge wall might protect the new territories of the East against the masses of Central Asia. But that's contrary to the teachings of history. The fact is that a too great feeling of security provokes in the long run a relaxation of forces. I think the best wall will always be a wall of human breasts. So what do you think there? He's, he doesn't think that building a wall to protect yourself is a good idea at all. Mm-hmm. And it makes you think that you're safe when you're really not. And mm-hmm. you just have to be prepared to fight.
Yeah, rather than the physical presence of a Great Wall of China to keep the enemy out, you keep your population on the alert against that enemy and be ready to stand against any incursion as a people. And rather than be lulled into that sense of security that wall might make you think you have, when in reality it's going to take your fighting men to stop such an incursion.
Right. So you always have to stay alert and have your forces and be ready. You can't get soft. for any reason. Okay, if any people has the right to proceed to evacuations, it is we, for we've often had to evacuate our own population. 800,000 men had to emigrate from East Prussia alone. Now, I think this is an important sentence. How humanely sensitive we are is shown by the fact that we consider it a maximum of brutality to have liberated our country from 600,000 Jews. And yet, we accepted, without recrimination, and as something inevitable, the evacuation of our own compatriots. Very, very meaningful, I think. And at this point, I guess, he's saying that we have liberated our country, or we have gotten rid of, you know, sent out somewhere else 600,000 Jews. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be, you know, we're seeing that as, oh, how cruel and brutal we are to do that, you know. I mean, that's what he's saying. This was now August 1941. We must no longer allow Germans, he says, to emigrate to America. On the contrary, we must attract the Norwegians, the Swedes, the Danes, and the Dutch into our eastern territories. They'll become members of the German Reich. Our duty is methodically to pursue a racial policy. Our duty. We're compelled to do so, if only to combat the degeneration which is beginning to threaten us by reason of unions that in a way are consanguineous, which is close family reunions. I thought this was interesting. We need to pursue a racial policy, and we must bring these other people in, the Swedes, the Danes, the Dutch, what have you, so that we can intermarry with these people, because we don't want to fall victim to having too close a unions, you know, too close a marriage unions, if it comes to that, where people are marrying people who have you know, similar ancestors that are too close. So, and then he says, as for the Swiss, we can use them at the best as hotel keepers. I thought that was really funny. If you know, Swiss are actually perfect hotel keepers. So I imagine he got a few laughs when he said that. I can imagine that some people, there's some chuckles going on. We have no reason to dry up the marshes. We shall take only the best land, the best sites. In the marshy regions, we shall install a gigantic plane for maneuvers, 350 kilometers by 400, making use of the rivers and the obstacles nature supplies. It goes without saying that it would be a small thing for our war-trained divisions to get the upper hand over an English army. It would be a small thing for our war. We wouldn't have a hard time,
he's saying,
getting the upper hand over an English army. England is already in a state of inferiority by reason of the fact that she cannot train her troops on her own territory. If the English wanted to open up wide spaces within their own frontiers, they'd have to sacrifice too many country houses. Another funny thing. You know, how long is this? Why don't you start reading?
Okay.
This is
really a long one. World history knows three battles of annihilation: Cannae, Sedan, and Tannenberg. We can be proud that two of them were fought by German armies. Today, we can add to them our battles in Poland and the West, and those which we're now fighting in the East.
I looked up these places, and so I might as well tell the listeners, they might want to know. Cannae was in the Second Punic War in 216 BC. So that Germany didn't participate in that. That was annihilated the enemy. But the other two, Germany was the victor. It was at Sedan, and it was the Franco-Prussian War on the 1st September 1870. And Tannenberg was between Russia and Germany in the first days of World War I, which ended up with the complete destruction of the Russian Second Army and the death of its commander.
All the rest have been battles of pursuit, including Waterloo. We have a false picture of the Battle of the Teutoburg Forest. The romanticism of our teachers of history has played its part in that. At that period, it was not, in fact, possible any more than today to fight a battle in a forest.
You know, I always wondered about that, Ray.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They say that then they fought this big battle with these thousands of people, in this forest, and they, I didn't see how that, and now obviously Hitler doesn't believe it.
Right. As regards the campaign in Russia, there were two conflicting views. One was that Stalin would choose the tactics of retreat, as in 1812. The other, that we must expect a desperate resistance. I was practically alone in believing this second eventuality. I told myself that to give up the industrial centers of St. Petersburg and Kharkov would be tantamount to a surrender, that retreat in these conditions meant annihilation, and that for these reasons, Russia would endeavor to hold these positions at all costs. It was on this theory that we began the campaign, and the ensuing events have proved me right. America, even if she were to set furiously to work for 4 years, would not succeed in replacing the materiel that the Russian army has lost up to the present.
Well, he was wrong about that.
Yes, that's exactly right. I had marked that. That was an error by Hitler.
Yeah.
If
there's no way to have known, you know.
No, that's right.
Yeah, I think there was, I think the USA, although you can see what happened in the World War One, but the USA was really, it just wasn't taken into consideration how vast and how much power it could, all that it could produce.
Mm-hmm.
It
went
into it. I think possibly that, even though he understood all these things, Hitler was such a European person, and you know, Europeans think in terms of, well, this, the great French nation, the great British, Germans, they were all in these big battles and all their history, and thinking of all the glory, thinking they were more than they were, and what was the United States, you know, and they're all so much smaller. They just didn't have that sense. He didn't have the sense of the vastness of Russia either, and all that it could produce. He didn't think it could ever have come up with all the industrial production that it did.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
If America lends her help to England, it is with the secret thought of bringing the moment nearer when she will reap her inheritance. I shall no longer be there to see it, but I rejoice on behalf of the German people at the idea that one day we will see England and Germany marching together against America. Germany and England will know what each of them can expect of her partner, and then we shall have found the ally whom we need. They have an unexampled cheek, these English. It doesn't prevent me from admiring them. In this sphere, they still have a lot to teach us. If there is anyone who is praying for the success of our arms, it must be the Shah of Persia. As soon as we drop in on him, he'll have nothing more to fear from England. The first thing to do is to conclude a treaty of friendship with Turkey and to leave it to her to guard the Dardanelles. No foreign power has any business in that part of the world. As regards economic organization, we're still only at the first fruits, and I can imagine how wonderful it will be to have the task of organizing the economy of Europe. To give only one example, what couldn't we gain by successfully recovering the vapors produced by the manufacture of gas for lighting? Vapors that are at present are wasted. We could use them for warming greenhouses, and all winter long we could keep our cities supplied with vegetables and fresh fruit. Nothing is lovelier than horticulture. I believed until now that our army could not exist without meat. I've just learnt that the armies of ancient times had recourse to meat only in times of scarcity, that the feeding of these Roman armies was almost entirely based on cereals. If one considers all the creative forces dormant in the European space, Germany, England, and the Nordic countries, Italy, what are the American potentialities by comparison? England is proud of the will shown by the dominions to stand by the empire. Doubtless there's something fine about such an attitude, but this will holds good only insofar as the central power is capable of imposing it. And I want to interject right there from something an Egyptian friend of mine told me. He's the same age as I am, but he was born and raised in Egypt and Alexandria. His family was well-to-do, wealthy. And talking about England being proud of the dominions, sticking with them and things like this and the support they had. And back over here when he said when the Shah of Persia will be happy to see us because when he does, they'll have no more to fear for England. Well, my friend from Egypt told me that in World War II, the Egyptian people were overwhelmingly hoping for a national socialist victory. And such was their hatred for the English, interloper as they saw them. The fact that Hitler, once again, the fact that in the new Reich there will be only one army, one SS, one administration will produce an extraordinary effect of power. In the same way as an old city enclosed in its ancient walls necessarily has a different structure from that of the new districts on the periphery, so we shall have to govern the new spaces by other methods than those current in the present Reich. It goes without saying that there should be no uniformity except in the essential matters. And once again, that's a tribute to Hitler's compassion for the people and wherever they might live and what their customs may be and what they prefer and what they used to. He says, as regards Austria, it was the proper solution to destroy the centralized state to the detriment of Vienna and reestablish the provinces. In this way, innumerable points of friction were removed. Each of the Gaul is happy to be its own master. The arms of the future, he asks. In the first place, the land army, then aviation, and in the third place only, the navy. Aviation is the youngest arm. In a few years, it has made remarkable progress, but one can't yet say it has reached the apogee of its possibilities. The Navy, on the contrary, has not changed, so to speak, since the First World War. There's something tragic in the fact that the battleship, that monument of human ingenuity, has lost its entire raison d'être, or reason for existence, because of the development of aviation. It reminds one of that marvel of technique and art which the armament of a knight and his horse, the cuirass and the caparison, used to be at the end of the Middle Ages. What's more, the construction of a battleship represents the value of 1,000 bombers, and what a huge amount of time. When the silent torpedo has been invented, 100 aircraft will mean the death of a cruiser. Now already, no big warship can any longer remain in one harbor. So that's the end of that. But you know what he's doing there? He puts the military forces in what he considers their proper order of sequence, and that would be the army or infantry, the aviation then, and then the navy lastly. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a very progressive viewpoint and realistic.
Well, right. The aviation has certainly took over,
mm-hmm.
didn't it?
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, I found it interesting that you were saying that what this Egyptian mm-hmm. hated the British. The British were the occupiers, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And Hitler, though, seems to be a little bit more thinking that people will accept, that these people will accept this this subservience because he thought the British were so successful mm-hmm. in their empire and it was all working very well. Mm-hmm. And they were pretty tough if people got out of line, you know, mm-hmm. The British. And so Hitler is really always enamored of the British and thinking that they were doing a very good job in keeping the world situation the way it should be. Mm-hmm. But then what happened was that while it appeared that everything was all right in Egypt, this you're saying that the people there really, at the first chance they got, mm-hmm. wanted the enemies of mm-hmm. of their occupiers to, you know, to their colonialists or whatever, to mm-hmm. lose. And they hoped that they would get something better from the next one. So there's, I don't know, this is something that is runs all along everything, and people have a lot of strong feelings about it. And there's, of course, there's been a lot of criticism of Hitler and that he made big mistakes by not trying to make friends with the Eastern European nations and didn't treat them right. But we know that his idea was not that they were going to co-rule, but that only Germany and this United Germanic League or whatever could rule, and the others had to play a more subservient role. Mm-hmm. And of course, that was that's still being talked about today. Mm-hmm. That was a wrong idea, or it couldn't possibly work, and that's why nothing did work. And I don't really think that is why the war was lost at all, because I think he was right in the fact that these people were all nationalists, you know, and they wanted only wanted to cooperate with Germany. They hoped Germany would help them, you know, with their nationalist plans. And if they were going to have their own independent nations, they were going to do what they thought was best for them. And then you weren't going to have this whole well-run organization that Hitler was envisioning at all. Because and then they also fought amongst themselves. Mm-hmm. So that's where things run into trouble. Mm-hmm. I think.
Yeah, it was. I had to give it some thought when my friend told me that he and his family and the people he was associated with are certainly the aristocracy of Egypt, and the aristocracy as a whole, according to him, was definitely anti-British and pro-German. You know, so I don't think he was speaking for the Egyptian masses. But
well, the Germans may have done a better job than the British, and certainly. Mm-hmm. Hitler intended to, and he wasn't going to be going into places far away, you know, and colonizing them. He wanted it to be one big, massive area that was all connected.
Right.
That is where the trouble comes in, and that there we come to racial and ethnic differences and so on. So, well, we didn't even get to the 19th and 20th, so we'll start there.
Okay.
Next week. We've got 30 seconds here, so we can say a nice, leisurely good night. What?
Good. I did want to point out one sentence that to me was overriding in this section that we just, and that's when Hitler said, "I don't want to force national socialism on anybody." And that flies in the face of the establishment historians teaching that Hitler wanted to conquer the world and force Germany upon everybody.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good sentence to pull out of there and keep in mind, you know, save somewhere. That's just one more example of him saying that. Well, okay. Good night, everyone.
Good night, folks.